The winds of winter will be announced earlier this or next year.
Yeah, no.
The Sanderson Empire is cringe and bad. And you write a book that is just a bunch of scribbles, just T's and L's and O's. That was a bit excessive.
When are you not?
Welcome back to another Two to Ramble episode. I'm one of your hosts, Austin.
I'm your other host, Richard.
Now, what we're going to be doing...
It's down.
I told him I wouldn't do it. I did it.
Put the stick down.
So, for this video, this is a part two, but you don't even have to watch part one. You can watch it after this one if this is the first video you're seeing. We're reacting to your book hot takes. The video we just shot, and it's on either Monday's or Friday's episode. We were reacting to your book hot takes from our patrons, and we're continuing that list because they submitted so many hot takes.
Yep.
We will agree or we will disagree. We will elaborate as to why we agree or disagree with you, and that's the gist of it.
Yep.
We didn't say this last time, but if you want to submit stuff, join our monthly book club and chat books with us. Our current book club of the month is The Lathe of Heaven by Ursula K. Le Guin. We're also reading Game of Thrones. We'll be having a community book club. Just a bunch of stuff. There's always community book clubs. We're always in there. And join or discard our official book club link in the description below if you want to do that.
Yep.
All right, Rich, let's get down and dirty. You ready
next
for this?
One.
Okay, next one. First one.
Next one for us, first one for them.
Yeah, just you got to suspend disbelief, you know? This is our first time chatting ever.
That's hard. So yeah.
Here is the first take, and we're starting off hot. Dom says this. Dom says, longer books are better. Why would anyone want to read less when they could instead read more? Sanderson gets it. Anyone claiming to be intimidated by a book must actually just not like reading that much.
Whoosh. Yeah. Hard disagree.
We both disagree.
Yeah. This is a hot take. I think this is an actual spicy take. Not just like, I think this opinion is correct. Like, very interesting.
They have a hot take.
But also, like, the only context in which I think this is maybe correct is there are store.
Wow.
It's distracting, man.
You think it was actually, like, I'm trying to annoy you. It's,
yeah.
It's really.
Well, you can play with the stick just below camera line. Like, that side, there you go.
Great. You can't see a thing. Okay,
good. That was just weird. That's right.
I actually just take it from me.
Okay.
I'm not trying. I'm very sorry.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
He's wrong. That's why I got distracted. Point being, the only case in which, like, longer book good because longer.
Yes.
Is mainly due to books where the characters are mostly like, you just like kind of following them.
Yeah.
Not necessarily what they're doing. I'm thinking like Dresden Files of you can make as many books of those as you want. You just really like the characters of the world. You will kind of be in that state. It's not about the character journey or the message or theme particularly. It's about the character. You want to follow them for as long as possible. Or you want to get the most out of your audiobook credit. And so you pick the longest book so you feel like you're not wasting money. That's it. Other than that, for the most part, shorter book better. If you can make your book shorter, you should. Almost every time.
Lucas III, his hot take, and I think we agree with this, was short and sweet stories are generally better than long and detailed tales. And I do not like the recent trend of fantasy books feeling like they need to be gigantic pieces of literature just to survive their genre. Which...
Is that his hot take?
Or? That was a hot take, but I was saying it was the same thing, but just in reverse.
Got it.
So I had them both there. It's the same. It's the reverse take of each other. And I agree with Lucas.
Completely agree. Yeah. No. For the most part, think about Lord of the Rings, of the masterpiece that book is, and how much world building it does. That it on its back is the entire fantasy genre. It depends on Lord of the Rings. It builds what you think of orcs, elves, and goblins. It's significantly shorter than Sanderson novels. Like, I think it is, like, the entire trilogy of books is only slightly longer than The Way of Kings. I think I'm right on that.
No, I think it's shorter.
Is it?
It might be.
You got a computer up.
I think it's definitely less than 400,000 words. Let's see. Lord of the Rings trilogy word count is 480,000. So you might be right. But that could be with appendices. Who knows? Nope, you're right. It's 480,000 words. So it is shorter than Wind and Truth.
It's shorter than Wind and Truth. And it's the whole trilogy. So, does a lot more world building in one book. In general, shorter, better. And that's not really like, oh, I don't have the time. It's just constraints normally help an author grow and make a better
book. Sometimes there's unnecessary details, unnecessary things.
And there's always unnecessary things.
Yeah.
It's get to the point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do agree with your take, too. When the book gets longer, you are more critical of what's included in there because what you're now asking, is this necessary? Is this necessary? Was this needed? Because it's a writer's trick of you describe a person's features or you describe a location. You go, they spent three paragraphs describing this person's forehead. I bet I'm going to have to remember that there's a lightning bolt there. That's important. And you go, okay, feature is focused on. Then you go later in the book and you recall it because so much time was spent on it. Payoff to that thing. So then if you just give a bunch of details and things and then at the end it's going, wait, did I read pages upon pages about something that was never addressed again? Oh. Or it's pages upon pages about something and it could have been told way quicker, way shorter.
Or the rule of cool, was it fun?
Exactly.
That's the exception.
If
you had a good time reading it, then doesn't matter that it was particularly relevant to the story as long as it was very fun.
Yes.
So if you just have a lot, so honestly, it's probably going to be my thought for, I haven't even read it yet, but book 7 of Dungeon Crawler Carl, I know I'm pretty darn sure it's the longest one yet. It's going to be a chonker, but it's probably going to be real fun. Like, could it be shorter? Maybe. But do I want it shorter? No, because every page is fun and I want more fun.
And book series, as they get further along in the series, we just talked to Ryan Cahill in the Patreon, the book club. He showed up for that. And he was talking about how his book 1 is shorter, 150,000 words in that range.
Mm-hmm.
But by the books he's writing now are 400,000-500,000 words. Because he adds point of views in the book. His original point of view character still has the same word count in each book. He's just adding new point of views and stories in there. So further you get with epic fantasy, it could bloat the novel.
To him, it's more of it was diluting. Like if you were increasing the page count, like increasing POVs, but keeping a similar page count, then you're diluting the main character's amount of time in the story. That's why the books get longer. He doesn't want to dilute the story, which it makes sense to me. So,
yeah. Yeah. Okay. Want to go into the next hot take?
Yeah. Read it. Then I'll hand it.
Andrew says this. The biggest lie in sci-fi fantasy is that world building matters more than good writing.
Read again.
The biggest lie in sci-fi fantasy is that world building matters more than good writing. Can I ask you clarification of question? Is good writing meaning prose or good writing meaning a good story? What do you think he means by that?
I would assume the latter. It is a
story. Good.
The story.
He's like, saying story, you think?
Yeah. That world building can make up for a bad story.
Okay. 3, 2, 1. Agree. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, you do agree. Okay.
Agree with sci-fi sometimes being the exception of the world and the story that is trying to take place matters more than the characters and the plot sometimes, where it's an exploration of an idea and that can make up for it. It happens.
I see your point. And so that's all. He also says this is the biggest lie in fantasy sci-fi. Do you think it is the biggest lie? Do you agree with that?
I think so. The amount of times people focus on just the world building in a fantasy novel.
Mm-hmm.
The only time that where that was the focus for me and that it actually superseded the story was The Lord of the Rings. That was the only time of, yeah, I cared far, far more about the world building, and that's where my energy was, than the plot and the plot of the story.
Yeah.
I also love the characters, and the character journey was also engrossing, but the world, I spent time, like, I stopped reading the book to then investigate the world building. That's a pretty clear example of the world mattered more than the story and plot at that time.
Did you ever pause the Lord of the Rings films to go do something else? Or were you just so engaged in those?
No, because it was all bang, bang, swordplay. I was not interested in the world.
You actually hate the movies, don't you?
Yeah, I do. They suck. Just trying to I'm with Christopher Tolkien. The movies suck.
So what Andrew's getting at here, I think he's in another way saying that ideas are cheap. Execution matters.
Sure.
Ideas are cheap. You can have the grandest, coolest, what if, wow, look at this crazy thing that I came up with that nobody else can. But if you can't have your reader feel that and get immersed, or maybe they can't get immersed in the idea, but it's just that. That's all you have, is you're the idea guy.
Yeah.
And plenty of authors do say this, that the ideas are cheap. It's, you can take, Sanderson uses this example of, I forget which other author it is, but somebody on some forum said, hey, take Pokemon and take the Spartan legions in Rome and try to make that into an idea. And he did, and made a very successful series out of that. But yeah, it is a lie. I would say, yeah, world building with fantasy and sci-fi allows you to give different perspectives, expands the possibilities of cool stuff you can do, but then you still got to actually execute the cool stuff.
Yeah. It doesn't matter, like, what is the world... It's C.S. Lewis's discussion all over again of what is the genre doing for the story? If the genre is just kind of like, oh, cool idea, and it's neat, it's a neat setting, cool, all you got is a neat setting, but you didn't do anything with it. That's the important part.
I definitely agree. We have this next one. I think this is repeat user from last episode. Dom, here we go, Dom. This is his hot take. He says, the difference between sci-fi and fantasy is stupid. You are telling me that writing fiction about what could be versus what is impossible is worthy of an entire different genre? I'd argue that 95% of what happens in a sci-fi book is completely impossible, and thus it should be considered fantasy. 3, 2, 1.
Hard disagree.
Also a hard disagree from me. Yeah.
The genres are different and matter.
Yes.
In general, yeah, no. I feel to even say, like, yeah, that is a hot take. Like, they're different. Ultimately, it's the difference between the impossible and the improbable. It is sci-fi and fantasy, where the really fun part of sci-fi is, yeah, sure, it's impossible now, but it's based in some grain of truth. And if they're done expertly, you go, oh, that really does seem like it could be possible. Like, the closer you get to, oh, that seems like how it would be, I think generally the better the sci-fi, where you think, oh, that is how I would see it happening.
Yeah. And even helps with a setting, where when you're pitching a book to somebody, and what is it? There's genre by setting and genre by, there's a two different types. What is it?
What do you mean?
Genre by, you know, you say, hey, it's this setting and this mood. So horror is the type, or coming of age is the type. I'm trying to look for that other word. When you pitch somebody a story, there's genre by setting and genre by, I'm forgetting the second part of that. Tone. Yeah, maybe that's it. But even when you just say, hey, it's sci-fi setting or fantasy setting, that's even helpful.
Yeah.
Of, you exactly know, okay, I get it. Either space and stuff, or maybe medieval, maybe flintlock, whatever, but it gives you a vibe of, is it futuristic or is it fantastical? Even that's helpful, but you're right. Improbable versus impossible. And sometimes...
When you start blending the genres, then sure, the point makes more sense. Mm-hmm. But the fact that the genres exist at all and don't matter at all, it does matter.
You'd say Red Rising is sci-fantasy, but you say sci first for a reason. Like, Star Wars has fantasy elements with the Force.
Yeah.
Obviously. But you think sci-fi because it's sci-fi setting.
Yes.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Now, it has those fantasy elements of magic. Yes, that exists. Mm-hmm. So it's a fantasy element, but you can even distinguish it pretty easily.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's important. So,
Dom, you're wrong. Disagree.
Disagree. Incorrect.
Next take is from Alex, and Alex says neither audiobooks nor traditional books are true reading. I read all my books in Braille so I can keep my eyes and ears free to watch Subway Surfer videos. Little aside to our last video. I hard agree.
Yeah, hard agree. Only Braille counts, actually. None of us have actually read. Hey, you out there listening to our video and you read in Braille, you're the real one.
Also, they were having a whole conversation on do audiobooks count because of the hot takes going back and forth. So that they're having a fun time talking hot takes in there. So, okay, here's a real one. Okay. Hot take from Chief of Dads. This is his hot take. Gary Stu's and Mary Sue's are the best characters if written well. I want to read stories about exceptional people like The Will of the Many and The Name of the Wind. 3, 2, 1. Disagree.
Yeah.
Disagree.
And there's a difference between exceptional people and Gary and Mary Stu's.
You took it right out of my mouth. You took it right out of my mouth.
I do that a lot.
I'm never take it away. So go on.
No, the point of a Gary or Mary Stu is they are the center of the universe. They do everything better than everyone else. All the good people like them for basically no reason. It's wish fulfillment, but bad wish fulfillment. That is the nature of those stories. It's the very different from, say, the closest comes to like Anakin Skywalker from Star Wars could be considered a Gary Stu in some cases because he is all powerful. The place revolves around him, but not everyone likes him in the sense of it's his downfall. It's not a kind of feel good story of everything goes well for him because he outshines everyone else. So it's not the same.
Yeah. Gary Stu, Mary Sue. Definitionally, this is just how I take it. And if you agree, I was looking up a little bit into this. So people differ, but mm-hmm. Gary Stu is someone without even flaws, just somebody that is exceptional, but also essentially flawless.
Yeah.
And of the examples given, so The Will of the Many, this is a character, no spoilers, we're not spoiling any of this stuff, but this is a character. You can take other main characters, Darrow from Red Rising, Harry Potter from Harry Potter, and so all these characters who their flaw, I think a lot of people sometimes conflate Gary Stu's with, oh, they get stuff done, and often there's not a ton of setbacks, but also they're good and they're hyper competent. Whether it's strength and they're powerful in some stories of wow, they beat the bad guys, or they're super smart and they outsmart the stuff. But then this is a character, his flaw in The Will of the Many isn't necessarily about is he able to beat the people. You'll get to the end what the thing is, but it's more a thing about decision making. Like, we'll keep it mm-hmm. at that. You know, that's part of the contemplation is with this. Now, I'll agree, if you're to give a spectrum of Gary Stu, are they closer to Gary Stu or closer to a flawed character, leans more in that direction. But when you're saying a true Gary Stu, that's your James Bond. That's your Sherlock Holmes. The character that's there and they're solving a problem in the story. It's more about what's the plot? What bad guy has to get taken down? What murder has to get solved? Let's Gary Stu this. You got your whimsical character.
If you want to give the actual context of where the term came from, because I don't know if people do know it. Maybe I think it's pretty well known, but maybe someone doesn't. The term Mary Sue, because that's the first term. Gary Stu is the male equivalent, but the whole story starts with Mary Sue, which is the name of a fanfic character named after the author of Star Trek. And the story basically takes place of Mary Sue is swept up by the Enterprise on some mission, and she finds out that she's on the bridge of the Enterprise. Kirk is actually in love with her, but so is Spock. you know, the Vulcan, the emotionalist Vulcan, he is also in love with her. Everyone's in love with her and are just so impressed with how smart she is. And bad guy, like the Klingons come in and the Klingons are intimidated by her and she saves the day. And ultimately, like it, that she is smarter than Spock and also more courageous than Kirk. And also it basically takes everyone else's role where the feeling of a Gary, Mary, Sue and all this is the side characters become pointless because they offer nothing because our main character does
has
what they do, but better. So why are they there? Mm-hmm. The plot revolves around them. Everyone likes them for basically no reason. That's kind of the
100%
aspect of it, where a good modern example is Rey Skywalker. She would be like pretty damn close to basically a Mary Sue, mainly because not just her competence in her lane, it's the fact that the side characters that she follow around her, she's better at all of their things than them. And it's going like, well, why are these side characters? The
fighter
here?
Pilot stuff.
Yeah, and she's as good as Poe as a fighter pilot. Like, why is Finn there? He doesn't do anything. Like, she's better than Han Solo at doing Han Soloing things. She's better at the Millennium Fight. Like, she is better than all the side characters to the point of why are they there? Then everyone likes her. She, like, it kind of goes on and on where it's like, eh.
Now, you know who makes fun of the Mary Sue character in a fun way?
Hmm.
Jane Austen.
Yes.
Jane Austen's character, Jane, is a fun Mary Sue.
Yeah.
Because Jane's just great. Nothing bad happens to Jane.
Yeah, she's great. But then again, she's not the main character.
No, side character.
Which is fun.
And is making it purposeful as well. It's intentional. Yeah, so completely agreed with you. And that is why the take from Chief of Dads was he wants to read about stories about exceptional people like The Will of Many and Name of the Wind. So the difference there is exceptional people in Gary Stu, Mary Stu are different.
Though I will say Name of the Wind.
That actually is a pretty Gary Stu-ish.
Pretty Gary Stu. Maybe not the same degree as other things, but has those seeds of everyone, like, other than the big bad and the big bullies, like, people like him for little to no reason, hyper competent and everything around him takes
knows
away
better
from
than his friends.
Yeah. So like, why are the side characters there? Yeah. Yes. All the hallmarks.
Yes. You knew we were going to disagree as soon as you said Name of the Wind. Come on. This next one's from Nick, our editor. How you doing, Nick? Here we go. On average. Oh, this is Nick's
below.
This is Nick's take. On average, when most readers have pacing issues, it is likely due to other problems they have with the book that they may or may not be able to put into words. This isn't a hard rule, of course. I'm not saying there ain't books with pacing issues. I feel like I have fallen prey to this exact thing myself, to be clear, but I really do think more so often than not, the supposed pacing issue is some combination of completely different things. So to put that into shorter, just to frame that and cut a little bit of meat off that pacing issues aren't actually pacing issues. There's some other problem that you can't identify. He's saying on average, that is his take. And can you give me a second to think about this one? I need a second.
I'm also thinking about this. Maybe. Like,
okay. I'll go here. I got a take. You got your take ready? Take your time. Think about it.
Okay.
Okay. 3, 2, 1. What'd you go with? I got disagree.
Disagree.
Yeah.
I think there is such a thing as actual pacing problems in the sense of if scenes were combined or cut, it would work really well. And that's a pacing issue. That's not another problem. So it's not a character flaw, like, oh, this character isn't coherent. It's just, hey, this scene goes too long. And the character could still be good, character still be interesting, but too much of that character or a wasted chapter with that character can drag and it can feel it.
Yeah. Nick's right here where sometimes you could say it's a pacing issue, but what he's saying is sometimes people can't explain themselves, myself much included. You can't explain yourself well enough to go, this is the exact issue I have with it. So pacing issue is a good cop-out straw man, whatever you want to say, back plan B to go to of some pacing thing here didn't work rather than this is the scene that could have been combined over there. And the issue you're actually trying to point out, So I see that point, but there's certainly when someone feels there's a pacing issue, the truth of it, there's a pacing issue because either there's these chapters should have been there, or again, that plot point could have combined with that to make it move smoother, or just generally
to steel man it.
Yeah.
If the character is not interesting or is not very compelling, and you have many scenes that are slowed down, there's not a lot of action, but you get time with the character.
Yeah.
Well, another person would say, oh, I think the book slowed down and that there was a pacing issue in the middle, where actually it's just the character was uninteresting to them and not compelling.
Yep.
And so that's maybe the kind of confusion of it. It's actually a character problem, but they will say it's a pacing issue. Mm-hmm. Or the plot didn't particularly make sense and it kind of all gets wrapped up at the end. And you go, I think there was a pacing issue. No, it's the plot was not properly thought out and that not enough was set up and everything was set up and concluded at the very end way too close together. That's a plot issue, not particularly a pacing issue, but they can kind of be confused between the two.
Yeah, definitely the case where, because there certainly are things we can think of in books that, oh, that pace was not good. And mainly when you just think of a story structure, generally speaking, act one should be 20% of the book. Act three, 20, or whatever the number, 25%. Act two, 50%. Act three, 25%. Not a hard, fast rule. You really like Save the Cat, How to Write a Book. Mm-hmm. They'll say that. People have different numbers. But generally speaking, if half of your book is act one and then you get your call to adventure, or this is not spoiler stuff, but Harry Potter goes to Hogwarts halfway through the book or toward the end of the book, or Percy Jackson goes to the other world, finds out his father's beside him. Like if that happens, that's a pacing issue because you didn't get to the story beat you needed to get to in a sensible time. Yeah. So something like that is certainly more pacing issue. Now, I said examples where that didn't happen, but just to go, there's other fantasy books where certainly
those are the rules. You can break the rules, but normally the people that do that successfully know the rules very well.
And their name's Terry Pratchett. So Nick, just because, I wanted to give you that one there. Nick, we have another Nick hot take.
Oh, we do?
Yes, we do. Here's his other one, okay? Books that warrant rereads are the best. If a book doesn't have enough to warrant extracting more off multiple rereads, it doesn't stand toe-to-toe with books that do. There's nothing better than coming back to a book as a slightly different person with more/different life experience and extracting more. Unrelated to this previous point, but one of Austin's biggest mistakes in life is that he doesn't do rereads, LOL, and then he makes fun of Red Rising. Disagree. I will reluctantly agree. What will you do?
I agree.
Yeah,
completely.
I'm reluctant.
For the most part, if all the if you can't get through a reread because all the story had going for it was the plot twist, you can value it for the plot twist, and that can be really enjoyable. It could still be good for that. But yeah, is that as good as a story that even with the plot twist revealed that you know? It still is valuable on its own? Yeah, I would think so.
I'm going to agree and disagree. Here's where my disagreement comes. Mm-hmm. Of there are certain books and films I don't want to read or watch again. I mean, The Night is a sad, you might not want to reread a really sad story. Mm-hmm. Schindler's List, or a film that gores you, once is enough.
You don't watch Schindler's List
on repeat?
Every Sunday or something?
No, but there's certain types of stories that only merit that one watch that maybe you just don't want to watch it again because, wow, that was it hit an emotion that you needed to experience, but once got the point across and still make it an incredible movie from. But a big point I agree with here is the reason I don't reread. I was actually using it for the props. Like I'm going, hey, when I said the word agree, I was holding out the stick, but that's okay. So what I'll agree with is I don't reread right now because right now it's still experiencing a lot more stories. There's so much to read on the catalog. Yes, we have to also keep up to date with so many series we're finishing. But at this current point in life, it wouldn't make sense to start rereading books that we started two and a half years on the book club on the podcast for me. Because if I reread Red Rising right now, first off, it's so fresh in my mind. I'm not changed enough as a person to look at that with a new eye of, wow, the sword was cooler or less cool this time around. So I think there's a lot of merit to it in two ways. And one, you just want a comfort read, and that's you're that kind of reader, and you get the vibes and go, ah, cool. Reading's a hobby to me. I want to feel good. It's like watching The Office in the background for you. Or two, you're now a parent, or you're at a different stage of life with a job, and you want to go back and experience this from a new angle. All valid. All valid.
But to the point of, if the book warrants a reread,
yeah,
if it can stand up to a reread, that is generally the sign of a much better book than something that can't. Mm. Recently, I've been doing quite a bit of rereading because I've read a book maybe over a year or 2 years ago that Austin hadn't read, but now Austin is reading it for the first time. So I'm rereading the book for the context of the channel. Like, I've been doing that fairly frequently. Mm-hmm. And I gotta say, I get quite a bit out of it on a reread. I've actually been enjoying rereading books in the sense of like getting something new out of it, or it alters my expectations. Because I already know the story, my expectations are perfectly set. You know, like, you don't have a, like, oh, what should my expectations be going into the book? There is no question. I've already read it. And so I can, once I know what the story is, I've read it, I can focus on other things to maybe improve my experience on a book, which is pretty fun for me.
Would you say the first read, you're the reader, the second, you're the author?
No, that's pretentious dribble. Where did that come from?
Give me a stick so I can whack you. Just, I want to whack you with it.
What the fuck was that?
This next one's from Kevin. Kevin says, my hot take is that middle book syndrome is a myth. Book twos of trilogies slap more often than not, and a large majority of the time, it is actually book one that's the worst one. Oh, there's so many examples of both of these. I'll say this. What will you say?
I agree.
I'll disagree.
I agree. There's so many in this genre that is
first book, yeah,
completely true, especially with like series that are planned to be series, not just like, oh, they continued on. So on a couple of factors. One, imagine a book series where it's the author's first work, like first published work.
That's where I'll agree with you.
One, is their second book going to be better written than their first? Probably, because more experience. So you already got that part going for you. If it was a planned series, first book is the setup. Second book, probably a lot more payoff, and not payoff, but you actually get more into the meat of the plot and what was set up, which is normally more exciting than the setup, unless it's, you know, poor execution where you like the setup and don't like the execution. Mm-hmm. That could be a point. Personally, it's kind of my thoughts with Hyperion. I like the second book, but I think the setup is better than the execution, ultimately.
There's plenty of examples where we've loved the book ones more with Empire of Silence. Or sorry, like them.
The opposite, yeah.
The opposite. Didn't like the first ones as much, and then the second ones, the middle books, were much better. Empire of Silence. What's the other one we recently read that felt the same? You would say Red Rising, right? I mean, I would say Red Rising.
Oh, yeah. We both say Red Rising. Yeah. Book two is better than book one.
They're both 5 stars for me, though, so it's hard.
One's clearly better.
Both 5 stars. But then, so those two. But I think the whole middle book syndrome thing that you just touched on there is so true, where if you're a debut author, if you're new to it, usually the first one's rougher and you get your stuff together and the book two's just an improvement in quality. However, if you're an established author and it's a series you're writing, typically the book ones, sometimes I like way more than the following ones. A couple examples are Mistborn Trilogy. Book one's way better than book two, I think. Lysolak Lamora, Scott Lynch, that was his first debut novel. I do know, so maybe that's an exception to the rule, but the first book is generally seen as the best one of the series, and then peters off. I second, still good, I've heard, but something there. But generally speaking, with the whole middle book syndrome is referring to, hey, the first book is set up and exciting and gets your gets a satisfying conclusion or conclusion to some arc that the author wanted to set out. And if it's a trilogy, the trilogy ends it and it's all that payoff and that wow catharsis. The middle book is just getting you from that setup to the payoff. So it just it could sometimes feel like progress and you don't get that oh moment. A lot of books don't do that, but it's tougher to say with something like Sunny Eater where it's seven books.
Yeah. Of,
can you even, what's middle book syndrome? What's Wheel of Time's middle book syndrome? Books 2 through 13?
Even then,
you know,
here's the thing, and the nice thing, maybe this is just perception and your expectation of it.
Yeah.
With Wheel of Time, there's, and this is how you do a good long series, is, yeah, there's a big overarching thing, but each, there's mini arcs, and like that's the important part. So it's not, oh, it's just set up for the big part, or it's just getting from A to B.
Yeah.
No, there is a complete story in there as well. At least generally what you do need.
Then I might argue in trilogies it's more often than not to have middle book syndrome than book ones be worse off. I think there's some exceptions to that, but
that was my biggest problem with Tad Williams' Us. The second book in the Dragonbone.
Is it Green Angel Tower or what?
Yeah,
what's it called?
The Stone of Farewell.
Okay.
My biggest problem with that is it. I almost find that like the definition of middle book syndrome of you could cut it. When I read the third book has two Green Angel Tower.
Yeah.
It has a whole section where it summarizes the previous book for you. And I read that going, that was just as good as the book. the book was a waste of time. Like it just got our characters like the point. Like the story couldn't continue until they got there, and that was the whole book of them getting to the thing, and it felt like pointless. Why am I doing cut to black? Please just skip the book.
Damn. I gotta read that book. Series.
I'm tempted to reread it again, just context, but because it is beautiful writing, and if you like world building, it's got it. I just didn't care about the world building, which is not good.
Yeah, that's
for a book that's like world building. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. So maybe that's it because the that is true. There's a lot of book ones that also are the worst, but typically those are for longer series.
Yeah,
typically,
I think so.
Yeah, Kevin, somewhat agreed and disagreed take.
Agree. Just in the genre, I've been finding far more book twos I like more than book ones.
That's fair. This next one's from, we got Levy again. He had a submission from last episode. This one here. Oh, this is, okay. This kind of is a bit similar to his last take. We kind of got into this. You tell me if it's worth it to discuss or not.
Okay.
He says, sci-fi needs to stop pretending it's smarter than fantasy. Just because a book has spaceships and AI doesn't make it more intellectual than a well-written fantasy exploring themes of power, morality, and destiny. I think we did touch on that a lot with the...
But rapid fire real quick.
Yeah, I'll agree.
Yeah, generally agree.
Yes.
You can have, now, depends on what you think is smarter, but I do have to acknowledge, like, there is something very impressive of, you know, a physicist being able to explain.
Mark Lawrence.
Yeah. scientific concepts into a story that is far more approachable. I think it's technically really impressive and very, very smart. But is...
What about a philosopher talking about morality? You know?
Yeah.
It can happen both ways.
Yeah, it can. Yeah. So I guess just a tendency is I think that a philosophy can be easier told in a story. Like that's kind of the right medium for it. There's something impressive about taking a mathematical or scientific concept that is very academic in nature and then building a story around it and explaining it in a way that is approachable and understanding and using the medium of stories to explain an academic concept.
So you think it is smarter?
That's a personal opinion of like, I find it more impressive. Maybe not smarter, but I find it more impressive.
Okay. Interesting. We did touch on that a little bit from last one, but I agree with the take that doesn't necessarily mean smarter. Maybe impressive is a good word to use, but it's also, let's change the word to impressive. Would you disagree if he was to say then it's more impressive, sci-fi is more impressive than fantasy?
Often, yeah.
Okay.
I would say so.
Interesting. I'd say disagree. Why would you say agree to that just because of what you said or anything else you have on that?
Yeah, basically. I just find it often more impressive.
Huh. Okay. Is it impressive to you because a lot of it is stuff that you aren't as knowledgeable about? Is that part of it too? And going, this is something that I can't understand as much because you are very much into philosophy, morality, like all that stuff. It's like you nerd out over that stuff. And so when something's explained to you that you know very little about, is that more impressive?
Maybe. It could be a factor, but I find sci-fi that is willing to take the... I find it far riskier with hard sci-fi because they have to be more accurate. They have to be as accurate to reality as possible. That often they have to put a lot more research into how space travel works. There's a lot more research, I think, involved with it because they're a bit more scrutinized, especially for the audience that it plays to. Rather with... when you're building a fantasy world, like anything really can go. As long as you are coherent in your storytelling, the world can be whatever. Versus a hard sci-fi world, like, yeah, I guess it could be whatever, but whatever with heavy caveats of it's got to make sense within the physics of our world or our world plus this new weird factor of to me. So I think Andy Weir does this some of the best of with Project Hail Mary is physics as we know it plus additional thing, like basically takes one concept, one additional change to physics and applies it backwards and extrapolates further on it, but still using as close to our understanding of physics as possible. That's damn impressive. That's really impressive to do rather than just magic.
So impressive and smarter, you'd say. Just trying to bring you back around because at first you were saying that you agreed. So maybe you do disagree with the take.
Yeah, I guess so. Sure.
You do.
I'll be a hardliner. I'll be a curmudgeon and say, yeah, it's smarter.
Yeah, you can feel that. You know, part of it for me, I think I get what you're saying with, let's say it's just a pure nonfiction book and it's math problems in a textbook. Would that be less impressive to you than a sci-fi novel because they're taking reality plus adding in an element so they have to do more work? Or would you just say nonfiction is smarter because you have to get everything right? Basically, an Einstein or somebody that is just doing math or science, is the more real something is or closer to reality, is that what's more impressive to you? Because it seems like the more you get into the fantastical, the less impressive it is to you, or the less effort that you have to put in to make it...
I find the accurate combination very impressive and smart.
So that point, it's not
making reality fantastical and making it entertaining and telling a cohesive story within the boundaries of reality is hard. That's when you put limits around yourself, which is a lot of good, hard sci-fi. It leads to very impressive, smart work. Now, great fantasy with wonderful, moral takes on leadership and the meaning of life and what it means to be human.
Bless you.
Thank you. Those authors can be very wise takes and lessons of life. But I don't know. I guess it's what I value and what I would say is smarter.
Okay. Fair enough. Levy. Good. That I'm glad we actually did talk about that one because it wasn't exactly the same as the prior episode when we did. Mm-hmm. Okay, now we got one from Ocean Wizard. Here's his take. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
He says, my actual hot take is that the Sanderson Empire is cringe and bad. He talks about himself so much as a business when the focus should be on literature. One of his responses to the Wheel of Wind and Truth criticism was along the lines of the team has been crunched. what author is talking about their team being crunched, and crunched for what exactly? You write the books, you set your own deadlines, even the weekly updates where he shows percentages, like, bro, just write the best book you can and it's done when it's done. The whole thing feels massively over-commodified, and at this point, I think anyone would be hard-pressed to say it hasn't affected the quality of his books. All right. You know what I appreciate? You said it with your chest, and it's a hot take.
It is.
It's an actual hot take.
Man, and...
Okay. What are you saying, Rich? Say it with your... You say agree.
I'd say agree. I just barely.
Disagree. I disagree.
And here's the thing. The commodification's great. When the gravy train's going, and I'm on board, awesome. But if I'm not into it, then it's cringe. It's kind of how it works.
So your most recent book you read.
Yes. It's not cringe if it's good, is, I guess, my take.
Yeah, I think, so I see what he's saying with it's affected the quality of his books. I would agree with one because, the recent one, I really didn't like the recent one. So that's true. But him having the team there and the Sanderson Empire is so that he can write more, is so that he can just go, okay, be as efficient as he can with his writing while also providing the audience with updates and trying to be the opposite of George R. R. Martin, of actually publish books and actually give advice to new writers. And yeah, I have my frustrations because of Written Truth, but the Sanderson Empire, with its flaws and with, hey, don't let it affect the quality of the work. Nobody else is pumping out books like he is at the success they are. And maybe success shouldn't be the word, because it shouldn't be a measure of how much it's selling, which I guess you are for a company. So the commodification in that way.
Is there a point of when the art becomes too commodified of it loses a bit of its artistic luster? Like there's
Marvel.
Like, when something becomes too commodified, it becomes a little cringe.
Thing is, with Sanderson, it has to happen with more than one miss for me to say it's been an empire issue, and the quality is going away in order for him to pump out books. And I see the complaints about, is he getting edited as much? Is he too big to fail in that way? Is he able to get the same level of criticism? There's probably a lot of truth to that, but I need to see another big miss for me to go like, yeah, he's going down the wrong path. I'm again trying to push back against my knee-jerk reaction of everything that Ocean Wizard's saying here about being frustrated with, hey, the quality of the book, and you're going for like crunching numbers and getting it out in the right time. I don't hard disagree. It's we've talked about it a bit on the channel. It's we're in a limbo state right now of we're acting on information that is, we need to see more. We need to see the next 5-10 years to see what actually, if this was actually a good idea or not.
Yeah. Because I'm thinking about you look at past videos of, because surprisingly enough, I was not around during the first release of the original Star Wars and all this. And
really?
But something that is fun to see in videos of that is how much people cared about those, and people dressing up, lining up, waiting for the premieres of it. There's something special when looking at it, of it doesn't look cringeworthy at all. There's some type of real joy from it where I look at that with like, oh, look how awesome that is. That looks really fun. And then you look at current Disney Star Wars and like Disney World or Land or whatever.
Yep.
And it just is cringe, the commodification. And a lot of that comes down to, if the product's good, then the products often can, like, it's not that cringy. But I don't know, is there too much of a commodification of an artistic medium?
It literally comes down to, how is the quality? No one's going to upset with high quality stuff coming every year or every 2 weeks. Hey, this is just hitting. Awesome. Marvel Phase 3, there was hardly complaints because the movies are just good. I'm having a fun time. More. Avengers, cool. Show up to the theater. You'll have your more film snobs, me, but you'll have your Scorsese's going out there saying it's not real cinema. And yeah, people were enjoying Marvel.
But high class entertainment.
Yeah. Yeah. People were entertained.
Not class. High quality entertainment.
Yeah. It was doing the thing. It was entertaining people. And then when you're clearly going for commodification and trying to sell, do you feel that the thing's been compromised where it's more about selling the product than getting good quality? I don't believe that Sanderson is.
I'm then with you when do you feel that the commodification has taken over the quality and that
yes.
the intent
yes.
is to commodify rather than entertain or yep. Produce better art.
Yes, and I don't think Sanderson and his empire, it's not a way of books are. Yeah,
I do disagree.
I think when in truth, I very, very much disliked. Very much. I don't think his intent was the book was going to sell. I don't think his intent was
to sell more Chull plushies.
Yeah. I mean, he wants to support the company in that way. Yeah. So there's so much merch you can buy from Sanderson Team in leather bounds. As far as the work goes and Wooden Truth, I believe he told the story he thought would hit and he really wanted to, which if you look on Goodreads, a lot of people love it.
Yeah.
He satisfied a ton of his audience, more on BookTube and criticism that you'll see. People with platforms didn't like it as much. Maybe were removed. I don't know. So I guess that's where it comes down to, where I do believe Marvel's commodified. They're just literally putting out stuff to sell. They're not putting artistic integrity into many of the things coming out. Disney does similarly as well. So
yeah.
Has Sanderson gotten there? No.
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 So time could tell, like, maybe 5 years from now we see, wow, you're literally just publishing 100-page books, putting these out there just to get a quick buck and da-da-da. But yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, do you want the next take?
Give it to me.
This is from the one and only Orcish Dad.
Ah, our best patron.
You say it every time.
I do, because it's true. Everyone must live up to the standard of Orcish Dad. He is our best.
So you're going
to
agree with his hot take no matter what?
Yeah,
no matter what. Put the agree thing up.
Preemptive agree.
Preemptive. Orcish, you're so right. You go. Orcish says, reading isn't as good for us as we pretend it is. We would be much better served by putting down our books and going for a walk. Instead, we pick up a book and lie to ourselves by saying that reading is the best thing we could be doing with our time.
Agree.
Does he say anything wrong?
Completely agree.
Why do you agree?
Yeah. It's all, you can overindulge in shit. You can live in the fantasy realm too much. That often you need to go out in the real world and do stuff.
Yeah.
I'll be honest, like, even now, without the channel, would I read as much sci-fi fantasy at this point in my life? Probably not. I've been wanting to read some different stuff recently and do some other things. Books are getting in the way.
Yeah.
Like, I have other hobbies. Yeah. But I've been trying to do a couple different projects. Like, I have a coding project I want to work on and I'm trying to do it. It's hard to find the time. I want to write more, but I gotta read.
See the struggle?
Yeah. At a certain, like, I enjoy the hobby, mm-hmm. but there's, like, too much. There can be such a thing. But
There is, and to me, I don't mind it because it's my obsession and passion, but even then, it could feel, oh, okay, I just don't want to read right now. this moment, there's other things you want to do, but if you're massively obsessed with something...
Well, it's not even just what I want to do, because I want to read all the time.
So you need
to. I want to, but I need to do other things. Mm-hmm. And
oh no, I get you.
The confusion of, like, oh, I'm reading, therefore I'm productive. No, you're not. No, you're not being productive.
This is the point I was getting at, where reading is one of those positive connotation hobbies where you tell your grandmother you're reading. Oh, look at you. Good boy. My reading son, my reading grandchild, it's encouraged.
Yeah.
Reading is seen good. If you're doing it, oh, great. It almost seems like you can't do an excess of it because you're reading. How could that be a bad thing? Wouldn't compare it to, do you want to, yeah.
I believe we're going to agree on the same analogy.
Yeah. I was going to compare it. Maybe it's different analogy. I was going to compare it to chess. I bring that up every now and then, but chess, I grew up playing chess, love chess. I got my account back. I'm doing really good. I hit 2050. It's the highest I've ever been on my ELO. I'm like, I'm feeling good. Thanks. It's not going to stay. I'm getting crushed. Okay. So I love chess. I love playing chess. And, actually on the Discord Patreon, we're doing a chess night. We got to plan that. But we're with chess, these GMs, the grandmasters, your Magnus Carlsons, and the people that are top of the game that are so obsessive with chess. Chess has a positive connotation of it's seen as an intellectual game. Mm-hmm. And when you're playing that, it's not, someone's not looking at you playing Call of Duty the same way they are of you playing chess. It's smart. It has that. And when you're just playing chess and that's all you're doing and you're studying lines all day, and hey, that's grandmaster's jobs. And sure, I get that. But at a certain point, it's chess. If I'm spending 10 hours of my day, especially if not, I'm not getting paid to play chess and I'm just doing it because I like to play chess. That's a problem of I'm playing chess like I would be playing you good?
Yeah, I just got something in my eye.
Oh,
that was it.
I could be spending. So if you're playing chess 10 hours a day instead of playing Call of Duty 10 hours a day, just because it's a quote unquote looked upon better hobby doesn't make it like that's a great productive use of your time.
Yes.
You know,
I completely agree. Where reading and books has a more positive connotation, I see it in the very same light as video games, where often video games do not have the same positive connotation. It's more positive now in the sense of it's not as frowned upon as a hobby, but it certainly is never seen as like it's really good for you that you're playing video games. Mm-hmm. No, it's never seen. It's seen appropriately as it's entertainment. It can be very fun.
Some people make money off of it. They
make money off it. Yeah, sure. Yeah. But I see most reading is the same way. It's a fun hobby that you spend money on. That like, could you spend that money in a different way? Probably.
Certainly.
Or do people spend too much time on it? Like us? Maybe. But we've also commodified it in a certain sense of we are entertaining, hopefully, other people with us reading. So there's something. I'm no longer just reading for myself. It's also to entertain others.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit better, not by much, but still. But, you know, yeah, it's an entertaining hobby that can go too far and not particularly productive.
You can be obsessed, but obsess in moderation.
Yeah.
Orca says go for a walk instead. Hey, you could walk in excess. If you're walking for 24 hours straight, that's not healthy. So obviously, Go outside, and Orchestra is basically trying to tell us to touch grass.
Yeah, very true.
We got to do that.
I try and do it.
We had a TikTok commenter for the first year, when we were smaller as well, for the first year of our career here on BookTube, BookTok. Every video, every short would just say, tell us to touch grass. Did not miss a video. Don't know what happened to them, but I wish them the best.
That's impressive.
They kept me on my toes of, wow, someone really hates us. We're clearly doing something wrong. We got to make a change here.
That means we're doing something right. If everyone loves you, you're doing something wrong, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you have a few enemies, you're doing something right.
You're not just staying right in line. You're pushing the boundaries well enough. I like that. Yeah. Okay. This next hot take is from Charlotte. Here we go. Charlotte says, hot takes. Art is highly subjective, and people are often too quick to label books as quote unquote bad that are perfectly fine, but not to their personal taste / not targeted directly to their demographic. Different cultures have very different ideas about what makes a good plot, character writing style. Language and stories are ultimately made up of concepts invented to keep a bunch of sentient apes occupied in the meaningless void of the universe on a slow march towards our own mortality. All right. I don't want to look what you're doing.
Ready?
I'm ready.
Disagree.
Me too, but was that a quick disagree from you?
Yeah. Ultimately, I do not subscribe to the philosophy of, you know, complete subjectivism of, you know, nothing matters, you know. Words don't mean anything. It's just
existentialism.
No, none of that. Like, we have standards and we're all trying to reach something out there. There is such a thing as good and bad. Now, you can provide better context of good for who, good for what, but that extreme does not, like, the extremes of it are not applicable. Like, I can write bad. I can write a bad story, and you can't, like, subjectively find your way around it. No, it's just bad. That's what it is.
It's, again, we had a whole video on the subjective versus objective nature in art. Mm-hmm. Obviously, when you're looking at a math problem, if you don't get it right, oh, you're bad at math or you're good at math. It's pretty easy to say what the good and bad is. If the goal of good is you solve the math problem, you're good at math. Mm-hmm. If you get the answer wrong, you're bad at math because there's an objective way to do the math problem. With art, and we talked about this in that whole episode, if you want more of that, we literally look up art versus, subjective versus objective. Tutor Ramble will come up there. When Charlotte here is saying, label the books as bad and talking about personal taste, that's correct in your own personal taste and subjective opinion of, hey, maybe something that 99% of people see as bad movie, like you grew up with, it's nostalgic, or maybe you just really like it. Who knows? You just like it. That's totally fine. When we're talking about in art, you can get more objective the more micro you get. We've talked about this where when looking at prose, you can get more objective about which story has more commas, which one uses language that is more...
You heard it from Austin. If you have more commas in your story, it's better.
It's a better story, exactly. So you can't necessarily be objective about, oh, I like this taste, therefore everybody must...
Yeah,
but there is such a thing. I think it was Immanuel Kant that said this, and I'll double check that. But Immanuel Kant saying there's a such thing as subjective universality. Even if your moral framework or your framework of the world is we're all these ancient sentient apes that go around and we're eventually going to die, subjective universality is the concept of such a universal amount of people think something about this book, or there's enough complaints or enough praise about the specific thing that there is truth in it somewhere because of our subjective experiences as apes. So even if you want to go so far as to say that, we all perceive things, we objectively, majority people objectively view this thing in a certain kind of way to where there's enough that it matters and there's something there that speaks to the human nature. Because if 99% of people are saying The Room is worse than Casablanca, like if you gave the two, okay, maybe there's that 1% of person that their personal tastes are, well, I grew up with The Room and I think that when my dog died, The Room was there to comfort me. And Tommy Wiseau going, hello, Mark, was the thing that meant the most. When you have that much of a subjective, universal human experience, can we say the word objective of personal taste exists? But it might as well be. Semantics a bit. It is important to define things.
The point is, there is such a thing as good and bad, but the first part of that point of people can be very quick to call a book bad when really it's just not to their taste.
Yet, very true.
That's very valid, and yeah, something we kind of struggle with quite frequently of... It's easy if I like a book, I'm like, yeah, I think the book's good. I have a clear, it works with the audience of one. Mm-hmm. That's what I can judge it on. But if it doesn't work for me, I have to ask the question of, is it a bad book or was it just bad for me? And that's something that requires reflection. And you have to think about, well, what audience is it going for? What is it trying to do? And does it succeed at that? And I go, oh, here's the caveat. Here's where you can find it on reflection. Mm. What is the book trying to do? Does the object of the story appealing to you? If it is, if what it's trying to do is interesting to you, but you didn't like how it did it, then it's probably a bad book, or it has some flaws that makes you think it's bad. But if you don't even like what it's trying to do,
the genre,
if you don't like the genre, then it's just bad for you and not a bad book.
Somebody else would love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that whole answer of Charlotte, correct in the way that, yeah, people, you're right. People can be too quick to say bad and not give more in-depth explanation like you just gave of caveats and going, this is who the book's actually for. This is, again, Charlotte mentions different cultures would perceive books a different way. All that is entirely true.
We talk about the save the cat, the you know, three act structure. Like, that is not completely, because I do know other non-Western cultures have something similar, but I do know that different Asian cultures have different story structures that are vastly different, that don't have that three act structure.
Japan uses Kishu Tenkatsu for theirs.
You actually got that right. I'm impressed.
Thanks.
I couldn't pronounce it.
I hope we got it right. Yeah.
Yeah. Then now I look like an ass where I said, like, you got it right. And it's just real wrong.
You don't even know. How would you
know? I don't
know?
Even know. How do I know?
How would you know I got it right?
Here's the thing. You did the same thing I do to you sometimes. I just said it with confidence. And like, I just believed you. I just immediately, like, you said that right off the cuff.
He said
confidence.
Something with like a hint of something that wasn't completely white. You know, he must know what he's talking about. Like, you know, I said it with some emphasis. Kishu Tenkatsu. You know, I said it like I knew what I was talking about. Like, I've studied the language.
And I believed you.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
I choose to. But yeah, no. But ultimately, disagree. But got some points.
Yeah. I think the knee-jerk reaction for my disagreement, but all these are it depends in a way. But that's not fun. And so
yeah,
the knee-jerk there is, you're totally right. Their subjective taste exists, and all the caveats in the world we could say. However, it's interesting to go, the more micro you can get, you can be objective about things in the story, which, yeah, you can never get to, you can never have everybody 100% agree on this is the thing like you can in math. No. But subjective universality, that term, and I'm really not trying to appeal, because the framework being used here of we're all sentient apes with our own subjective experiences, yeah, of course. Of course. But even looking in that worldview, there's some, you can look deeper and aspire to a greater thing. Because if that's the case, like, let's say that you go into that writing a book and going, hey, there's personal taste for everybody. And somebody's going to say something's bad. Somebody is going to say something good. What if you go there with that attitude? Not attitude. I'm not trying to say it like that. But what if you go in there with that mindset and you write a book that is just a bunch of scribbles, just T's and L's and O's. That was a bit excessive.
When are you not? But to that,
the point being,
to that mind frame,
why wouldn't you write slow, slow, slow 100 times?
And why, when someone says, I think that's really bad, that's a bad story, you go, well, it must be good for someone. If it's good for someone, it means
like
it's
for
good.
Me, like, I wrote it and I like it.
It doesn't make it good.
And the reason we're using extremes, because this is, we cannot make the same example and talk about, hey, The Will of the Many versus Name of the Wind. Although we love one of those books way better. That's where it gets gray, because people like both books. It's their qualities are so different, because they do some objective things well with writing. Mm-hmm. They have a standard of, hey, for one, everyone could read the words in the language and culture.
It is comprehensible.
You can't deny that. Versus the tlo, 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 objectively, you can understand those books better. So
you get, but you take that, peel that further back of, there are stories where it doesn't properly get across, like, the setting of, like, I don't know where these characters are, like, or your confusion of time, events, places. Like, their editors exist for a reason, because the book was worse and now it's better. Well, that means it, like, there's some degree of an actual quality control. It's not just nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're all looking for different good things. Charlie's an example of, there's people are looking for different plots, characters, writing styles. Fair. People care about different things. When things are given awards, the Hugos or go to awards are given, they're looking at a certain quality. In much case, you know, when we're critics looking for certain quality, we have different types of taste too. So that's why we'll disagree on books. So just going, hey, for you're saying, I didn't feel get immersed in the world. I'm saying, oh, I didn't feel the atmosphere this was going for. So it's a negative quality. But then another person could read that book and go, oh, I don't care about that at all. I just care about this part of story. And anyways, hopefully that got somewhere. Good job, Rich.
thanks. Good to you, too, for your too low, excessive.
Low.
Yeah.
You know, thanks as well for the pat on the back with the Kisho Tenkatsu. That meant a lot.
I won't do it again.
Next person, Numbria. And thank you, everybody, here for being patrons. But again, just to reiterate, Numbria says, my hot take is for the past 2 years, I have found better books in the indie market than traditional market. Almost everything I read was indie and of enviable quality. I think because they can keep their own voice, even with editors and all the revisions, these stories are more authentic and fill the gaps that trad publishers are leaving behind. 3, 2, 1. Also disagree. Yeah.
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 Here's the thing that it's not always true, but what I look for in the indie space is novelty. That's, I think, where you're going to find the most unique and novel ideas for stories that publishers were often, going to round off the corners and trying to publish stories that they know will succeed because they fit in these genres and fit in a nice box. So I get that. But traditional publishing does have some degree of quality control that I find is at least normally better on the whole.
Yeah.
The exceptions exist,
of course.
That's at least how I see it. It's also a numbers game of there's so many more indie books. If you find the best ones, you're probably going to get a few more of amazing ones than traditional published where there's less. So
it's definitely survivorship bias where there are a million books, hundreds of thousands per year coming out that you will never hear about that will have zero reviews on Amazon, that will have one review on Amazon, nothing. And you'll never know because it was self-published, indie published, and just never got to your attention. Whereas a bunch of trad books that you're aware of, you might not like several of them, but there's an audience for them and they did sell and they have this more marketing behind them.
The worst traditionally published book is better than I would say the average indie published book. And that's not a dig on indie authors that we've talked with, because mainly it's I see the numbers and I've seen through it's just so many books of that went through no editor. We have thankfully been the great part about the indie space now is that it is far more accessible to actually access editors and pay for editors and beta readers with the internet. That is less of a barrier than it used to be. But there's still a lot out there that it's just first draft material and it's just on there, one review. That has to factor into the equation somehow.
And the indie authors we're talking to have gone through a bigger vetting process than the indie authors you've never heard of.
Yeah.
Because those people had enough reviews or attention or awards, something that
recognition of just
brought it to our attention. Then we went, oh, look at this person. We've never had an indie author on here that had just came in bare with nothing we've heard of before. In that case, the indie authors we've
not just that we didn't hear of, but nobody else has heard of.
Right. We have people, I think Keith Entrante who came on might have had 20 reviews on Goodreads. There's nothing much at all, but he emailed us, seemed like a fun guy, and he had something to show about his book that was interesting in the topic we were doing. We didn't read his book. We can't read every book, obviously, that comes here. Honestly, his book sounds really cool too. Shout out Keith, and his book is, oh my God.
You want me to cut?
It's a very cool cover.
Nick, with the cut eyes. When I find it.
Yeah, we're going to find it real quick.
All right, back. Let them whimper.
Such a cool cover. Shout out Keith. Now, we haven't read the book, of course, but seems like a great guy. Super cool concept. And he's just an awesome dude. So
yeah.
Let them whimper. And books like this where super not even close to being on our radar, but we just get an email and in some way seems cool. We have them. So that does happen too. Basically, the thing to say is there's so much that is published every year you never heard of. And when you're saying the average of indie books, let's say 100,000 books come out in a year, you're saying 50,000 of those books, like the 50,000th book is the middle, the average.
Mm-hmm.
And X number of trad books are published per year. It's a lot, but not as much as indies in comparison.
Now, hey, you want to change this formula and this question here of the average of the indie books that that you read is better than the traditionally published books.
That's different.
That maybe is different. Like that I could maybe even agree with you on, because if you are self-selecting and you're finding the indie books that are actually, went through the ringer and have some degree of recognition following, like, then maybe you're right. And that's very possible.
Numbri is saying here, it's the indie market than the traditional market. So if you're talking about the market as in what's popular, what's selling.
Mm-hmm.
So Sword of Kagan is one of my favorite books ever. Indie published, self-published book. And if you're going to those and seeing, hey, what is the most popular indie book coming out? Those are going to be way higher quality just because it's been vetted by more people.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely the case. Okay. Numbria, thank you for that one. Now we have one from Levy.
Is this a spicy one?
Ooh, it's an actual hot take.
Oh, okay.
Levy says, Tolkien's influence has held back fantasy as much as it helped it. Even everyone worships his work, but for decades, fantasy was just trying and failing to copy him instead of doing anything new. That's really interesting because...
kind of agree.
I can't disagree with what he said.
In the sense of how much do you value novelty, and there's something of the reason why personally why I think Japanese like anime and manga appeals so much to a Western audience is mainly the novelty of it. Of it comes from a culture completely, not completely, but separated from general Western media, that you're getting some unique stories. And now a lot of fantasy in Japan is influenced by Tolkien. That is true. But there is some degree of uniqueness of it. Of I'm trying to remember this. There's a manga I was reading that is fantasy, but is so removed from Tolkien. It's so refreshing. It's in no way related to Tolkien. Wow. Like there's not the elves, nothing. It doesn't even have the same feel, but it's just as fantastical. It's not like Tolkien with a twist. It is its own unique thing. And
people will get that
magical.
In like Studio Ghibli.
Yes.
Those kind of films will give that different vibe.
So yeah, to some degree, maybe. But then again, how many great stories are built off the backs of these things? So, yeah, that's a hard thing. That is a hot take.
I specifically like the point is held back as much as it helped it. It really is true that for the next several decades, there were just copycats.
Yeah, that is true.
Nothing was pushing the genre forward. People were reading those kind of books as, oh, maybe I can get that same high that the best of them got me with Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
So that's definitely true. At the same time, puts a face on the map of fantasy, pushes forward the genre in many ways. Epic fantasy is now a thing because of Tolkien. It's just not without him. So it pushed forward with all the epic fantasy we know and love is there because of Tolkien and the success it's had, the pop culture influence that it's had. So I would say the agreement and disagreement is there's a conversation to be had of it's pushed forward fantasy, but also held back fantasy. And I don't know where to weigh the scales in that. I think maybe here's what I'd say. I would say it held back fantasy for the next couple decades until people figured out how to take those lessons and a new generation came and twisted it up a bit. And after those following decades happened and we got new stories that added on or changed element or did the anti-Lord of the Rings. I mean, that's why Game of Thrones exists. It's just one of the reasons his biggest influence was Tolkien, and he wanted to put a bigger difference in not just morally black and white, but morally gray characters. And you get Song of Ice for a lot more reasons too, but
well, it's the idea that Tolkien and Lord of the Rings put a frame and put a fence around what fantasy is and defined fantasy. And whether you were the anti-Tolkien or the Tolkien copycat, it's still Tolkien is framing the narrative rather than it just being magical and really anything, exploring beyond the boundaries of Tolkien.
Yeah. There's a lot of stories we've read, too, that you can go, wow, that has nothing to do with Tolkien.
Oh, yeah, plenty.
There's plenty of those.
You go beyond the, like, sort of truth, you know, the Terry Goodkind stuff that's basically copycats of better books. And it is a Tolkien clone with extra steps. But you go beyond that. A lot of modern fantasy has learned the lessons from Tolkien without actually copying Tolkien.
Yeah.
I think.
When you have that much of a staple, and I guess this happens in art too, and it depends. Maybe this is the interesting thing about fantasy, where art and movements over time have general periods of artists doing similar things. The Impressionist era with your Monet and other sorts, and artists follow a trend, and maybe there's someone that revolutionizes that, that pushes it forward. However, it's people are doing something, it's fashion. A lot of people are wearing certain style, doing certain style hair, or maybe a famous person has that haircut, but you kind of forget who did it in the first place. But generally that's adapted. Whereas with fantasy, it's not as if there was a bunch of people doing this certain thing and that became popular, but it's one book series came out, changed everything. And now that's the example. And everybody knows where its beginnings are for epic fantasy, whereas just different artists doing things, it's tough for to change a genre. Does that happen too often?
I would say so. There are defining figures, especially in the, you know, art history, that define a period of art. And often, like, the whole cycle of art and also memes is you have the revolutionary, the, you know, something new, or, you know, let's pick a starting point, something new, then there are copycats, then you go into the subversion stage of where you're trying to subvert or deconstruct the thing that was popular, the current hegemony.
Joe Abercrombie.
Yeah. And then that itself gets its copycats and then eventually gets... Oh.
So basically Song of Ice and Fire, then Joe Abercrombie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, you do have that kind of pattern of, you know, basically it's the ever the same story of, like, you don't understand me, Dad. This is who I really am. It's not a phase.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
Even when you think music in different decades, it's, you're totally right. I don't know enough about art history or maybe even music to say this, but the 80s has its type, a style of song. 70s has its disco, 80s have its rock, 90s have its rap. You can put down in decades what was popular. And in hindsight, we can go, oh, Michael Jackson was the 80s. Or you could look back in 70s and pick a band and say they defined this and they were huge. But there are also several you could look at. And there's Metallica's and to the Queens to the ABBA's, and I'm naming different genres everywhere. But just, you can look at Nick, our buddy Nick would know a lot more about this. He's a huge Led Zeppelin fan. You can look back at rock and say, who was the defining feature of rock? Did it really start with Elvis and jazz? And who knows, right? Did Elvis revolutionize it? But when you're going in music, it's is it that common where you could go into the musical genre or just define the era with, this was the artist, this was the song that did it, this was the art piece? I don't know enough about it, but in fantasy, it's so clear that it's Tolkien. Can we do that for other things? Actually, if in the comments, let us know if you guys come up with anything.
If you want to talk about, like, rock and roll, I mean, just on pure popularity scale, like Elvis. Elvis is one of those figures. Same thing with, like, you know, the Beatles. Like, they are literally them. there are some individual figures that define,
revolutionize. Yeah.
Well, they just inspired so many different types of copycats. How many different bands after the Beatles were basically the Beatles, but worse. I don't know.
Yeah.
I would say so. But Yeah.
Yeah, I guess there are some like that that just there's transcend. Some,
but yeah, there is something unique of it's Tolkien and it's only Tolkien.
No one's close. Even when you said Beatles and Elvis, like you could think of
some other things around the same time, yeah.
But okay, let us know because we're getting the territory we don't know as much about. But yeah. that is where we need a Rockio on here to tell us the exact history of the world. And we need a Jarvis or something.
That's the benefit of podcasts with guests is the hosts get to be ignorant about everything. And they bring on and people listen to the guest because they're bringing on the expert knowledge. Mm-hmm. We don't do that often enough. We're dumb and we refuse to get someone in that's smarter than us because of our ego. Also, getting guests and scheduling that is hard.
Agree. I have one last one for you.
All right.
One last hot take from Tanoi Karaxis. Here we go. The Winds of Winter will be announced earlier this or next year.
Yeah. No. It's not coming out.
No.
Sorry to say, I hope I'm wrong. I'm hope this can be clipped. I don't think it's ever coming out.
Question. Do you think Winds of Winter or my book will come out first?
Oh, your book's coming out first.
Oh, baby. Here we go.
No question.
Let's go. I still have 10 years. Yes. Yes.
Oh, God. Yes. Yeah, no, I don't even think it's about writing at this point or like it's why? Why would he? Like, there's no monetary incentive. I think finishing
this,
at this point, there's more of a risk of him releasing it and it sucking and disappoint. Like, the expectations are now so high that it could be off. If he releases it and it's real subpar, that's the end of his legacy.
Mm.
So, like, why would he?
Do you think he'd have a post-mortem release? Posthumous release?
I don't think so.
Do you think it could potentially...
He said he doesn't want to.
Doesn't want to do that?
He doesn't... People have asked him, of like, hey, if you die before you finish this book, like, have you put anybody in the wings? Have you shared the story with anybody that would finish it? He says, no, I don't want anyone to finish my story. It's me or nobody.
Dang.
So, oh God. The fact that, if I'm wrong and Winds of Winter does come out eventually, like, that next one ain't.
Also, how insulting.
There's another one.
How insulting must that feel if people are saying, hey, you're getting old. If you die, which might be soon, who can write your story? Imagine getting that question. He's going, what the fuck?
That is insensitive. That's a really insensitive thing to ask someone. It's sometimes relevant. Doesn't mean it's not relevant, but it's real insensitive.
Just being reminded of both your mortality and your lack of commitment to finishing your series.
Also,
every gut punch.
The complete... we like to pretend as humans that we care about our fellow man, but asking something like that is just such a, I only care about what you provide to me and I don't care about you as an individual.
Yeah.
And it's just blatant of like, yeah. You facing the end of your mortality. Yes. I completely understand. But when are you going to give me the thing that you're supposed to do? Do it until you die. You know, do it before you die, you bastard.
Yeah.
So
that's got to be tough. However, do you entirely sympathize or do you just half sympathize?
Oh, I only partly sympathize.
Okay.
Nah, the guy's had way too long. He's had enough time. At this point, it's a bet he's made. Oh, well.
Winds of Winter, if it comes out this or next year, that hot take will be right.
Maybe.
Those were our hot takes. Let us know what you think. Any other hot takes in the description. What did you think of our takes on the hot takes, our agrees and disagrees?
Let us know if you agree or disagree.
Let us know if you want a return of the sticks with the agree and disagree. I love them.
How much were you doubting me of like, were like, oh, let's do it, agree, disagree, like just print off a paper. And I was like, nah, we need sticks. And I started just like fiddling.
You said, I get, put your hand on this long stick. Okay, you brought out the chainsaw. Just started, what's that called?
Circular saw.
There you go. He knows the terms.
Just saying, went above what was necessary for the video. And
you know, you went above and beyond. I'll agree with that. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for watching. We will catch you next episode. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, y'all.
Plan on flying? It's time to upgrade to a Real ID. Because in order to board domestic flights, your driver's license or state-issued ID must be a Real ID, or you'll need another acceptable form of identification. So don't wait. Find out how to get your Real ID at tsa.gov/realid. That's tsa.gov/realid. Or visit your local DMV. And then you'll be cleared for takeoff.